Hi everyone, you are welcome back. I am back in studio this week with the lovely Lynn Kennedy. Hi Lynn.
Hi,
how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
You're so welcome.
Thank you.
Lynn has joined me from Dublin, Raheny, and she had a reason to be in Galway today anyway, so we're going to chat about that in a little while. But obviously we're going to sit today and have a conversation about, I suppose, your life really.
Yeah.
Some parts of it, the loss you've experienced in a different type of way also. But so I suppose, again, to get a picture, I love to go back. And we're going to obviously speak about your dad today.
Yes.
So maybe if you wanted to tell me, where are you from and what was your mum and dad like and growing up and all of that?
Yeah. Okay. So so I'm from Raheny originally. I'm one of three. So I'm the eldest of a younger sister and then a younger brother. Mum and dad, they married really young. They married at like, my mum was 18, my dad was 21, and then they had me 3 years later. So yeah, young parents. It was nice growing up with the young parents. They were kind of cool. Just a normal kind of upbringing, really. Mm. There's nothing particularly remarkable. Very close as a family. Like we were, and we still are, you know, really close as a family. But yeah, no, that's, yeah. Dad was a welder. So he always kind of worked from home, which was nice. Like, I mean, as in he would have a workshop in the garden and then he'd fit gates. So I suppose that was really nice too, just having him around a lot, which maybe not a lot of people would have necessarily had.
So it's nice to have his presence there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So there was always, like, I always remember Tuesdays and Thursdays were the days he fit the gates. So we used to be, I just used to love Monday, Wednesday and Friday because it just meant he'd come in from the workshop and we'd all have dinner or we'd all be around, you know, that kind of way.
Tell me about your dad then. What was he like?
Oh gosh, where do I even start? So he was just, I think to just keep it really simple, he was just one of the loveliest people and the most authentic people you could ever meet.
Okay.
So he was really interesting though. I described him, you know, before as a simple man in the sense that he was, you know, he wasn't really into golf or he wasn't really down the pub with the other men watching football and drinking beer. He wasn't that kind of guy. Dad was, he was gas. Like he was, I suppose, because he was working for himself for so long. He was kind of just the kind of person that once his family were happy and provided for and everybody was okay, he was really happy then, you know. So he'd work really hard all week and then he'd come in at the weekends. He was really into movies, like most of the best movies I watch with my dad. My mum's not a movie person as such, so she'd go off to bed and then especially like over Christmas, dad would be like, do you want to stay up? We'll start watching The Godfather now. You need to watch, it's a classic. And you know, he loved his music and he loved just the cinema and family time. He was, that was the kind of person he was. He was really healthy, like he was practicing Tai Chi back when he was manifesting business, when back in the recession, when everyone else was going to the wall. The steel delivery guys were like, how are you still in business, Peter? Like, honestly, everyone's going to the wall. And he was telling me, I remember sitting across from him at the dinner table and he was like, so this is how you manifest, and telling me that he visualizes the phone ringing. Now, this is back before websites, before any of
this
that.
This is 90s, like that's 2000s.
It. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 2000s, kind of, yeah, 2000. So when the recession kind of hit around 2007, I was working in finance. So we could see firsthand investors pulling money left, right and center, funds liquidating. And then dad was like, you basically imagine the phone ringing. You know, I remember just being like, this is so interesting. And like now, you know, look at the amount of Instagram accounts about manifestation, about everything.
It's
and
everywhere.
Dad was kind of ahead of us.
Where was he? Did he read a lot?
Yeah, he read a lot. Yeah. Mm. And he was really into the mind and he was, I always remember him saying to me, and you know, it's really poignant now, but like the mind is on a hair. He'd say that to me and he'd say, you have to kind of train your mind the way you train your body. He was very fit and healthy. We used to laugh at him. Like, I mean, he was so finely tuned. He couldn't have soup without putting a million seeds on the top. He was cider vinegar. He wanted to work forever. I always remember him saying to me, I want to be really fit and healthy so I can work for as long as I can. And I was like, Dad, you make gates. How would you carry gates in your, you know, late 60s, because he used to say, I could work to my 70s if I really wanted to. I was like, why would you do that? You know?
I wonder, why did he want to, do you think?
To
stay busy?
Well, to be honest, he lost a lot of his pension with the recession. That was a tough blow for him. And I think he was a bit worried about that. But no, I think he was just one of those people that once you stop, that's it.
And he loved to be active.
He loved walking. As I say, he practiced Tai Chi. He was just really authentic. He was the kind of person, you wouldn't walk into a pub and hear my dad. but you would see him in a quiet corner talking to someone. And then I remember people saying to me, oh, your dad at the wedding was gas, because my mom worked in pharmacies for years. So she would have had friends and still does that are young, much younger than she is. So they went to a couple of weddings together. And I remember one occasion where one of the girls who was at the wedding was like, your dad is hilarious. Like, we had such crack with him. And I was like, my dad really, like, he barely drinks. Like, he'd have a few pints of Guinness, you know. Oh, he loved a nice meal and a glass of wine, but like nothing major. And they were like, no, he was up on the floor, but he wouldn't need to be drunk. He was light on the loafers, as we used to say. Like, the girls would come in, we'd be going to a disco or something, and my dad would come in and go, oh, there's all the girls dressed up. Now, listen, girls, are you ready for the funky chicken? Let me show you how it's done. And he'd be in the middle of the floor. But that was kind of dad. He was more, he was just a really kind of a lovely person when you knew him, but he wouldn't be someone that everyone on the road would know. You'd have to have bumped into him and had a conversation with him.
He didn't need to shout and make his presence known and I'm over here.
No. Yeah. And actually, he believed ego was kind of the root of all problems.
Ego there, yeah.
That is, yeah. And he wasn't like that at all. If you met him and you had a conversation with him and you told him something really meaningful, and then he had a book that might be of interest to you, he'd go and get that book and he'd put a little handwritten note on it. He'd drop it at your door. Like, he used to do things like that all the time. You know, I look back now and I'm like, God, that was just magic to have that growing up, to see, especially a man maybe kind of getting in touch with his own emotions. And, you know, he was great. Yeah, he was.
He sounds like so even confident that I don't need to assure of himself.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's spot on. Yeah.
So then, you know, knowing how he was, I suppose, where then did anything change in him or?
Yeah. So my mom and dad were like best friends right up until that point. But I think they had separated and we always knew that that was on the cards. Okay. And actually my parents were very open with me in particular as the eldest, maybe, about the fact that they would always wait till my brother was 18 and then they might separate at some point. And to be honest, knowing the relationship they had, I don't think I suppose until it happens, you kind of go, well, look, if everyone's going to be happy and that's going to be, we kind of grew up with our parents, if you know what I mean. I think when parents marry young, you kind of grow up with them and you see things unfold. And I was like, okay, I can understand that. Like, my mum is a totally different person, would be very sociable, would have always had a big network of friends and, you know, and I suppose, yeah, so they decided to separate and then they both had separate relationships. And then I think my mum moved out, which was really tough on her because dad worked from home. So it made kind of more sense to have that bit of separation. But I always remember my sister had already moved out. So she married and had her kids young. So she had already moved out. And myself and my brother were at home. And I remember dad saying to me one day, it's not the same when a woman leaves a home. And I said, I know. And I was really like, what do I need to start putting more potpourri around the place and, you know, try and make it a bit more God love him? Like, he was so... But what he meant was obviously nothing to do with that. He was more like the soul kind of goes out of the home a bit when, you know, years later.
The mother figure.
Yeah.
Within his family.
That's it.
Although he might have been happy to have had the separation, but.
Yes, still, exactly.
And you know what? That's grief in its own ways. Even though you might want to separate with someone, it's probably not what he planned for life.
No, it's not. And I think it really was years later that really affected him more. You know, we had another relationship and I was really surprised, not that he would ever meet anyone because he was a great person, but more like through his work, he worked for himself. It was hard, but he did. And that didn't work out. And my mum's relationship didn't work out. And they decided to move back in together and make it work. Yeah. So it was a total.
Wow.
Yeah. We were all a bit like, oh, is that a good idea? And, you know, and they were like, yeah, you know, we've been through thick and thin for so long that, yeah, no, I think that will be fine.
Oh, I love that.
And I thought, yeah, okay, well, that makes sense. So around, I'd say 58 and a half, dad got depressed. And that was a first because he was, not that anyone can obviously suffer with depression, but dad was just so logical and put so much into his mental health and put so much into his physical health that it wasn't making sense for me. I remember going, that's really, no one should have to suffer with depression. But you know, when you kind of look at someone who's really been proactive about their mental health, often we neglect our mental health, don't we? And we're kind of eat healthily maybe and we think that's it. But he had done so much with his mindfulness and his meditation. So that was really tough. And it took it out of him in a way that we couldn't have foreseen. And my mum had suffered with depression. So we grew up in a house with depression. So we knew what it was like. But my mum, maybe as a role model for someone dealing with depression, was someone who really was like, you kind of have to be proactive. You still have to kind of get out there. She had a family to raise too, and she was working. And, you know, you take your medication and you try and get your fresh air and you do X, Y, and Z. Whereas dad was floored. He was like, I don't want to be on the medication. I don't really take medication. This isn't for me. I remember meeting him. We used to meet a lot for lunch and brunch and things like that and have really good conversations. And I remember we were walking back up the road one day. We were in somewhere local, and I'll never forget him saying to me, this has really floored me. And I was like, I know, it's really, really tough. Like I said, I don't really know, but I know from mom how tough it is. But I said, you will get through it. I used to use all the positive things that he would always tell us when things weren't going well. And then something definitely changed at one point, and I can't put my finger on why or what it was, but he just lost himself a bit. And I think when everyone's busy, it's only now, like, I actually look back, there's one particular event, family event, and there's photos from it, and it's really important for lots of reasons. But I remember looking at him in that photo and going, the lights were on, but there was nobody home at that point. And I don't remember thinking that at the time talking to him. Like, I just don't remember that. Because I suppose we had the experience of years and years and years and years of depression, but you get through it somehow, you know? So when dad really was struggling, I don't think we really fully realized how much he was struggling. Like, even though he told us and we check in on him and I'd message him all the time and try and see him like every weekend or whatever was going on, or even on Wednesday, call over Wednesday evening, are you there? I'll come over. And then he'd go through stages where after that, then where it was a bit up and down.
Tell me, so when this change occurred, I suppose, when you first realised he was depressed.
Yeah.
Like, he was obviously very open, or did you notice it?
He was open.
Was there an event that happened or anything like that?
No.
You know, like a loss of a job. It was just it just came over him.
It just came over him.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he was struggling with more so, was the fact that nothing happened to make this happen. You know, it wasn't. I do think, I remember thinking when mom moved back in, that would be the answer to everything. You know,
so he was feeling that way a little bit.
He was feeling that way a little bit before. Yeah, I think it was creeping in at that point. Mm. And then she moved back in, and I thought, you know, this will be great for them. They'll have each other, because they were the best of friends. There was nothing they couldn't talk to each other about. And even with relationships and different things, it was very unique and very special. So I just thought, well, you know, mom is there. That's really good now that he's not on his own. Because, you know, at that point, my brother was moving on with his life. I had moved out. And I remember he was definitely very sad when I moved out, because I think the two of us were very similar and he loved all of us equally. But I think I was there the longest as the eldest. So to have someone there at 27, it's a long time to have someone at home.
Okay.
And we would share a lot of the same views and thoughts and tastes and things, music. Like, one of my earliest memories is dad bringing me to Vic Gates, and like, he'd have Fleetwood Mac on in the car, and myself and my sister to this day just love Fleetwood Mac. Dire Straits, Peter Gabriel, Kate Bush recently with Stranger Things when that song went to number one. I remember being sad and happy, going, dad would be so happy that she got that song to number one eventually, you know, stuff like that. So it just started to go downhill, and there was a lot of conversations around the antidepressants.
Was he working at this point?
He was. Still? Yeah, no, he was. He was. He was kept going. Like, he was working.
So he just wasn't feeling great.
Just wasn't feeling great.
Went on the antidepressants.
Went to the doctor. First thing. Yeah. Didn't want to go for ages. Mom was the one who talked him into going.
Okay.
She's like, you have to confront this head on.
Okay.
He went, doctor prescribed antidepressants, obviously. And dad was convinced they didn't agree with his digestive system. So okay. I think I was saying earlier, he was very finely tuned.
Yeah, yeah.
He would, you know, he would be like, this is upset. You know, I remember going, but dad, you can't. There's a solution for the problems you're having with the medication. You know, it's not necessarily, we just stop taking it.
Yeah.
I said, you know, and my mom kept saying to him, you know, you can't just stop. And he kept saying, yeah, I know, I can't just stop.
So he would keep taking them.
He would keep taking them.
So then when you say that time of the family photo, is this a number of years have gone past?
So no, he suffered with depression for about 18 months.
Okay.
And but so it was intense.
When you, let's say a couple of months in and you, yeah, on reflection,
yeah,
you say there was, I suppose you'd slipped even deeper in.
Yeah.
What's happened then that around that time?
That was, we all knew at that point, this is where we were with the, I don't think I can keep taking the antidepressants. And we were like, no, but Dad, you have to. Because we were definitely worried.
Right.
Now, he was a great man for going and doing his acupuncture. And he was trying to do things. And we were like, it'll just lift. It's just going to take time. But it wasn't lifting. It wasn't kind of lifting. Like, he was still able to work and he was still able to function, but he was definitely more withdrawn. There was definitely, I wasn't living there at this point, but I remember my mom saying he wasn't out and about as much. He was a bit maybe clingier to her, even, what are you doing this weekend? What are you up to? Like, just didn't want to really go out and do anything, wanted just kind of people to be there around him, and which is understandable. Mm. The family event was much later, and that was when he was really, really bad, you know. Like, I mean, I met him on Father's Day 2014 with my brother for brunch, and he was feisty. He was talking about the government, and he was probably giving out about something, and you know, and he rarely was feisty. He was very calm, very, very, I would have said, level-headed person for sure. And then he was like, oh, and they're doing this and they're doing that, and he was a bit caught up in it. So there definitely was, I think, a concern around his pension, and there was definitely, I would think, some worries about the future for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably played a bigger part than maybe we thought. But I also, when you're depressed and you're not, you know, things that maybe aren't major things do become major things to you when you're in it, you know. So then we get to 27th of June. And it was a Friday, and I was working late, as usual. And I remember we had a friend coming over, and my husband said to me, well, we were 12 weeks pregnant that week, the Wednesday. And I had told Mom earlier on, because she was staying overnight. Kieran was away at a stag or something. I don't know what he was at, a night away or something with the lads. And she stayed over, and I wasn't going to tell her. But of course, couldn't help myself.
Could
we have a glass of something? No, actually, no. So I told her, and she was over the moon. She was like, this is great news. This is just brilliant news.
It was your first.
First, yeah, yeah. And I remember kind of thinking, I'm not going to tell Dad yet.
Right.
Because I want to wait and make sure everything's going to be okay.
Okay.
Because I had no experience. This was her first pregnancy, and I just didn't know
if
something could go wrong. You know the way. So I rang my dad to tell him. Normally I would tell him face to face, but I remember it was during the week, and I was like, I need to kind of tell him now before. I didn't really want to dominate the Father's Day thing because my brother was going to be there too, and I didn't want it to be. So I was like, I'll phone him and just tell him. And his whole reaction to it was, what I would expect. That's great news. I'm delighted. Will you tell Kieran? I'm delighted. That's just, you're going to be a great mom. And, you know, all the lovely things that he would say. But I remember him asking me, does your mom know? And I said, oh, yeah. Course, like, and he knew, he grew up with a wife and two daughters and then a son, so he knew the girls told each other everything. And I remember him saying, did you think you couldn't tell me? And that is so out of character for my dad. I remember being really taken back, and I said to him, oh God, no. I said, look, I was worried if something went wrong, and I didn't want to add to everything else that you have going on, and I just wanted to make sure that, you know, we were kind of in the clear. To someone, you're never in the clear, but like, until, you know, before I told you. And I remember immediately regretting saying that, because normally something like that wouldn't faze him, but I think it bothered him, not in a negative way towards me, but I think it was, I would imagine he was doing a lot of reflection on himself, and I would say he was thinking, God, they don't feel like they can tell me these things. They don't feel like they can bring bad news to me, or potentially bad news to me, or anything that could go wrong.
Mm.
And that stuck with me. I remember thinking that was really weird. Like, that was very unusual for him. It's just so, because Dad didn't make anything about himself. It was never about him.
And also, so, if you go back to what we were saying, like, I suppose what I picked up there is very confident man.
Yes.
And then that sounds like someone that's really not confident anymore.
Absolutely.
And even a bit, not paranoid, but a bit like, thinking they're not good enough to come to or, you know, isn't it funny?
It
sounds really, like a different person now.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
Mm.
Like that nearly, I remember thinking that there's nearly a borderline paranoia going on.
Mm.
And that was very strange. But like, honestly, so the 27th of June was a Friday night. And that week there had been weird and wonderful things kind of happening all at once. Obviously we were telling, kind of starting to trickle out the news to kind of close friends and family. But mom was going through a little bit of torment with dad that week, and I didn't realise that. And she had said to me, will you come over on the Saturday? And I said, yeah, absolutely. I said, no, I want to see him anyways. I haven't seen him since I told him and whatever. And I was working late. Something had kicked off, as it always does, because I worked for an American company. They come into the office and then there was something a few hours later. Everybody was gone. And my boss, who was amazing at the time, she said to me, look, we're not saving lives here. It's a Friday night. Go home. Now go on. I want to see you gone. And I was the head of a team. So like when the last person on the team went, that's when I could finally finish up my reporting and get it sent. And there was one guy still on the team. And thankfully there was, because this thing kicked off, which was nothing. And I said, would you mind going through the mailbox and just, you know, sending them everything they're looking for, just because it was sent and they said it wasn't. And there was a whole big thing. And I messaged my husband and said, go ahead. One of her friends was coming over for takeout. Go ahead and order. I'm going to be a bit late. This thing has kicked off. I don't know how late I'm going to be. And he said, okay, yeah, Grant, that's fine. I'll try and get out, you know. And I said, yeah, no, I will. But he was well used to me at this stage. So we got everything out. My boss was messaging me, going, okay, I have everything I need now. You go on, I'll handle it from here. And I said, Grant, fine. So I left. Owen was gone. I left. And I remember thinking it was weird because it was like an hour later or whatever. My husband hadn't messaged back. And I was like, gosh, he's probably catching up with our friend and, you know, having a chat or whatever. And I came home. And so I don't know what time it was. I honestly can't remember. I'd say it was about 9. I came in the door, and we lived in a duplex at the time, so you go up steps, and the kitchen's in the front. And I'll never forget just opening the door. And our friend was kind of had his back to kind of the sink and was just kind of looking at the floor. And I remember kind of saying, oh, hey, Paul, how are you? You know, like, and he's the most jolly over bear hug kind of friend, you know. And there was just, he wanted to smile, but he just couldn't. And he was just, his eyes were fixed on the floor. And I was like, is this a joke now? Like, you're going to have to cut out these late nights because, you know, you're pregnant. I honestly thought nothing of it. But then it went on and on. I was like, where's Kieran? He was behind the door. He's like, Lynn, I need to talk to you. And I was like, oh, okay. I was like, okay, guys, whatever this is, like, it's late now, come on, you know. And he just went on down the hall, you know. So I followed him down. And I remember saying, someone died, like, what's going on? And there was just silence. And that's when I went, oh, God. So I went into the sitting room. I remember my husband, I'll never forget it. He was telling me to sit down, but actually he had to sit down. So he sat on the edge of the couch. And I was just standing in front of him going, just tell me, what's that? I said, is it your mom? And I only said that because Kieran's dad passed away when he was a baby. And his mom, he's the youngest in his family. His mom's a bit older than my parents. So she's a wonderful woman. She's in her 80s and she's absolutely flying it. But I just assumed she had cancer years before. And I just kind of, that was just the first person. And I thought, oh no, don't tell me. And he was like, no. And I said, is it my mom? And he was like, no. And I went, and I didn't think of that. I actually remember going, who do I say next? Because the healthiest person in our family, it just didn't occur to me. Like, of course, there's lots of ways people can die. It could have been a car accident, could have been anything. But it never occurred to me, you know, sudden death. I just assumed heart attack, or we'd had a heart attack in the family before. So I just thought that's what it was. And then I could see he just needed to get something out, but he couldn't verbalize it. And I was like, what was it? I said, oh my God, was he killed by someone? Like, what, you know, like a car or whatever. And he just said, Lynn, he took his own life. I was just so shocked. When you think of, when you talk about it like this, he was depressed. Of course, what did you think was going to happen? You know, it wasn't obvious to us at any point that he was suicidal. Like, it just wasn't. It's only when you look back at the photos or that, you know, that you go, God, I can really see he'd lost weight. Like, he was a tiny man. He was like this really slight little man. You know, he was never overweight in his life, but he had gotten thinner, you know. But obviously you're like, look, he's not himself, you know. He's probably not eating as well as he normally would be. It was just shock. Just complete shock. So I sat on the couch at that point And Ciarán, I remember, just said, I'm going to pack a bag. I need to be with your mom and your family. And I was like, yeah, okay. And so he went. And then our friend came in and he sat down. I don't remember him even coming into the room. And then he sat down. I just remember he said to me, are you okay? And I must have asked Ciarán who found Dad and what had happened. Because I remember saying to him, my mom's never going to get over this, ever. And he was like, really, like, you know, I suppose we probably wanted to go, no, look, you will be fine. It's not the time to be reassuring people that they're going to be okay. So we left the house. I have no recollection of crossing the M50. Apart from one point, I remember saying to Ciarán, is this actually happening? And he was like, I'm afraid so. And I just thought, oh God, I can't. And nothing. Like, I literally could have been on another planet. I have no, like, to this day, really struggle to recollect kind of a lot of the detail, kind of more. So we got to the house and we pulled up and there was a guard in the driveway. I remember that. And I walked up and I could see the door was open, but my mum, brother and sister were kind of back down the hall. And the guard just said, sorry for your loss. And I remember just going, oh God, this is actually real. And just going in, I remember my mom, I'll never forget the image of her. She was kind of flapping, like, you know, with just pure stress. Like, she was just, and I think in hindsight, it was seeing me coming up the driveway. I could just see them, you know, I could just see how upset they were. And as the eldest, that was really hard to see. You know, my sister and brother were obviously devastated. My mom was really upset, but they're probably looking at me going, you know, being pregnant and everything. I don't know. So I went in and I think that was the first time I cried, but I actually don't remember. I don't remember crying, but I'm sure I did. I'd say at that point it became real. And I honestly couldn't tell you. My sister's friend was there and she was making tea and it was just everybody had a different kind of, everybody was at different places in terms of knowing what was really going on. But the conversation very quickly turned to, you need to decide if you want to see him. And I remember my mom like kind of getting out, I don't know if this is a good idea. You have to remember you're pregnant. And, you know, and I was like, oh my God, what? Like, and they were like, he's still here. They brought him in from the workshop and he's upstairs. And my sister had to go up. Well, not had to. This is the kind of person my sister is. She's a carer. She's just incredibly kind and thoughtful. And she would be thinking, it's better my mom sees him another way the last time. So she went up. And she took off his work boots and she put on his little tighty slippers and she made it look presentable for my mom. And my mom went up and then I was like, I just don't know if I can see him. I don't know. And I was trying to kind of make a decision and they were like, just maybe don't. But my sister's kind of one of those people who would never tell you what to do. Like, she's amazing. She's real like, do you think you need to see him? And I was like, I don't know. I said, I don't know what I'm seeing. Like, I don't even know. So.
It's really hard.
That. It's so hard. I look back and I go.
There's no answer.
Everybody else did. And I, you know, I carried that for years.
So you made the decision not to go up.
I did make the decision not to go up. I suppose if you went and then it had a really bad effect and then you'd be going, why did no one talk me out of, you know, the way as humans, we kind of, we want to make decisions, but then maybe we're kind of thinking maybe we shouldn't, you know.
It's just lingering on that moment. Like, it is difficult because, yeah. Of course, you are actually, and you were early pregnant.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose shock can be very harmful.
Yeah.
You know? But then you had this massive
shock
anyway.
Then you were already in shock. That was my kind of thinking.
And then there's that part where, if you didn't, you have to, that's something that you carry for years, which you just
that's
said.
That's it.
Yeah. And I can understand why you would. Yeah. There
was no right
way. It's just what happened.
Yeah. And I kind of look back now and go, but now I'm not pregnant. So if I was to, you know, if something like that was to happen and you weren't, then yeah, I would have. I definitely would have. I wouldn't be the type to kind of shy away from things like that. But I remember being very conscious that I could regret this. And I was also very conscious that everyone around me really didn't want that for me, and I suppose for them. Like, imagine hearing someone upstairs, the devastation, you know, it's a lot for everyone to carry. So that night it was there was just bits of things coming out about the week, and you know, he'd been to the doctor that evening, and I was like, what? Like, he'd been to the doctor, and Mom was like he would, the doctor would have asked him, was he suicide? And he would have had to answer that question. And I was like, how did that get, like, I know the way it's there, but you kind of go, how was that not picked up? How? But yeah. It's a question and there's an answer, you know, and people know what you want to tell them. And I think that was all very, I kind of couldn't digest everything that was being said, and we were all just all over the place. And then we stayed that night, got up the next morning, and I remember just the reality of it hit, you know. And just for days after it, we were just like, people are coming and going and they're lovely, and the messages are coming through. My husband was kind of ringing some of my very close friends, but I wasn't really keen on telling anyone that wasn't really close. I was like, do you know what? Unfortunately, it's the kind of thing, and we live in Raheny, it's a close knit, you know, people are going to know about it. But I didn't know if I wanted to kind of be just obviously telling everyone and anyone, but I knew it would get out, obviously, and it wasn't a secret, but it was, yeah, there was just a handful of people that needed to know. And then I suppose there's talk of, you know, the funeral, and we had to wait for the autopsy. And so we got the go ahead for the removal on the Wednesday. So Dad died on the Friday. So I remember kind of that night, that evening was interesting. So I always think you remember the really lovely, heart touching things that people say or do. And then I remember, you remember the other things that people say that you go, God, imagine saying that. Why would you say that? Like, and obviously people don't mean any harm, but some people do just say things that are a bit questionable.
About how he died?
Well, a group of people were in our kitchen. Mm. And I remember saying, I didn't know them, but Dad had taught us from a young age how to even answer the phone, because all of his customers would have come through the Golden Pages or been referred. But either way, it's the house phone back in the day. And so we were always taught from a very early age how to kind of mix with adults, and, you know, and I remember saying to a group of people, you know, sorry, I don't know, because I didn't know, because Dad worked for himself. So there's a lot of people there I wouldn't have necessarily known, like, that weren't just close friends. And I remember going up to this group of people and saying, hi, I'm, you know, I'm the eldest, and thanks for being here. And, you know, and then they were saying, oh, I'm so-and-so, and actually did your dad's acupuncture session on Friday night. And I remember just going, oh gosh. And I said, how did he seem to you? And he was like, fine. He seemed absolutely fine. And I remember feeling for that man, going, God, you saw him so close to when he died. And I didn't even see him that close. Like, it was like a fact-finding mission. I wanted to know, what were other people seeing that day, that, you know. And then I remember somebody else in the group, and I don't remember who it was, but I remember just a voice coming in going, did he know you were pregnant? As if that would have made a difference. And I remember just feeling like, I just said, yeah, he did. Like, because it's the truth, he did. Like, but then there was just silence. No one said anything. And I remember just excusing myself and going to the bathroom and going, oh my God, I hate this part. I hate all the people and the questions and the, you know, and in fairness, no one else asked that question. And, you know, but I didn't know if there was more of this to come. And I remember thinking the funeral, oh God, how are we going to get through this? You know, so.
Take your time.
So we had, obviously, we had to prepare the eulogy. And I remember thinking, okay, I'll write it. I'm the kind of writer in the family, so I would have been nominated with the writing it. And I was happy to do that. I said, okay, look, I'll take that away. That's something I'll do. I kind of need to summarise who he was and, you know, get my head around it. So I remember going home. I was like, to my husband, I need to go home and sleep in our own house because I just have stuff I need to get, you know, men packing a bag. Like, he did a great job, but I was missing a load of stuff, of course, you know, underwear for 2 days. And, you know, it was funny. I remember saying to him, I'm missing so many clothes. I need to go back. I need to kind of figure out what I'm wearing for the funeral. I need to write the eulogy. So I wrote the eulogy, and I wrote it pretty quickly, to be honest. It wasn't difficult to write. I just wrote from the heart. It is a very easy man to describe. There was nothing complicated about Dad. In this, not in a bad way, in a really, in the nicest possible way. Yeah. He was a man who knew what was important, and he was simple in what he wanted in life, you know. So I wrote the eulogy, but obviously the conversation, sorry, even before the removal, was who's going to deliver this? This is probably back on the Tuesday. And my brother said, my brother doesn't, he's a man of few words. He doesn't say very much, but when Alan says something, it's usually the most intelligent thing you've ever heard. And so we're all sitting there. My mom's friend was home from the Isle of Wight, and we're all sitting around, and mom was like, will you read? And I said, I don't know if I can read. Let's just read it together. So I put it on the table and everybody was reading it. And she always referred to dad as Pete. All his friends back in the day were always referred to him as Pete, which I always thought was really funny because we never knew him as Pete, you know. But obviously that's your parents before they're your parents, have a whole other life. And they were like, it's beautiful. It's just him. It's perfect. And then we were chatting away going, who's going to say it? And we're like, we'll ask maybe our uncle and maybe we'll ask, maybe Kieran will do it, you know. And then Alan just went, I've decided I'm going to do it. And I remember just going, oh, God, love him. I was like, Alan, are you sure? Now, you know, we're the clucking hen kind of type sisters and mother, really annoying in his ear going, now, are you sure you can do this? Are you, would you be able, because my sister had said early on, she would do a million other things, very practical, but she was like, reading the eulogy will not be for me. And I said, yeah, and it's not me. I just got too emotional. It'll just be a sham. We won't do him justice. No way. And then Alan goes, no, I'm going to do it.
Oh.
And I just was so proud of him. Like, he did so many things that week. I was so proud of him. But that was just, I remember going, like, he's the man of the house now. Like, he's at home with my mom. It was just the two of them. So the funeral came. It was an absolute disaster that morning. Thank God for the undertakers. Like, we were leaving the house open. There was windows open. The car door wasn't locked. There was just so many things. They're just so amazing. We're forgetting the gifts. Our heads were just not screwed on at all. And I remember just saying, though, before I left the house, I was like, now listen, I believe in that my granny's around me. I know this sounds weird and it wouldn't be for everyone, but
not at all.
I really do believe that. I've been told that before. And so I remember saying to her, now listen, I need to hold it together. I cannot fall apart at this funeral because I need to be strong for mom. And that's just how this needs to go today. I can fall apart tomorrow, but I cannot fall apart today because I can't have her looking at me pregnant, falling apart. And, you know, she just needs to kind of get through this, and it's going to be so tough on her. And we got through the whole day, I think, remarkably well, if I'm honest. Like, I look back and I'm like, God, I can't believe that was me. I'd cry at the drop of a hat. And it went quite well. Alan did an amazing job with the eulogy. I'd thrown a little joke in at the beginning because I felt like everyone needed
to cut the tension,
settling. Mm. It's such a difficult funeral to be at, you know. And I just thought, no, we need to capture his sense of humour early on. And so there needs to be something in here that just makes everyone go, maybe this won't be a nightmare, you know. Now, obviously, there's a lot of touching stories and a lot of nice things in there. But yeah, I think he would have been proud. But we left and did amazingly well, held it together, did brilliantly. We left. That was the funeral. And honestly, after that, it's just kind of a blur. You know, I remember I was off work that week because he got 5 days when a parent passes. And I remember my boss going, oh, she needs to, this is not any, you know, and it's sudden death in general, you know. It's just, I couldn't have got, like, the funeral was on the Thursday. I couldn't have gone back into work on the Monday. I'm running a team. It's really busy. I can't be on calls and falling apart. And, you know, I remember thinking, no, I need longer. And I was someone who, when I was sorted off during my pregnancy, didn't take time off. Like, I wasn't someone who took time off easily. So I went, took another week and went back in. And then that whole thing of being strong during the funeral just started taking on a life of its own. It was like, you know, oh, I can turn this on and off. That's great. So I'd bawl crying on the way into work. Then I'd pull myself together in the bathroom, fix the makeup, go into work. No one was allowed to mention that. No one can mention, you know, it's business as usual. I want laughter on the floor. I remember saying to the manager of the team, I was like, I want everyone just being themselves. I do not want any reference made. I can't cope. And I know that's terrible. And I know human nature is that you would want to say, I'm really sorry. But I said, I can't function. And she was like, okay. So the team were young, so they were great. So, like, you know, I remember there was a bit of a joke, and I remember joining in to really encourage them and going, like, that's grand. They're going to get back to themselves. Everything's going to be great. Crying on the way home, get home. I was just, I don't know whether everyone's like this. I just couldn't grieve in front of people. Just, as I say, crying here on a podcast, but I couldn't break down.
I remember, you know, when you're pregnant, you wake 4 o'clock in the morning, I remember going, Grant, this is my time, you know. Went into the bathroom, crying my eyes out, back into bed. And my husband goes, you were up a lot. And I was like, oh no, I wasn't, just gone to the bathroom as usual, you know. I think it was 6 months later when he went, are you like, what are you doing every night? And I was like, I'm just, it's the only time I can grieve in peace. I mean, work all day, I'm here. You know, I just couldn't, I was scheduling it, you know, and I was turning it on and off. And about 3 weeks after the funeral, I had a hen party, and it was my friend's hen party. So there's a group of my friends from Trinity from our undergrad, which would be kind of relevant as well later. But I remember one of my friends asked myself and another friend to be bridesmaid. And it was really funny because my other friend was like, I'm sick of being bridesmaid. I've been bridesmaid 5 times. And we had a joke about it. And our friend who was getting married was going, I knew you were going to say that, but I know Lynn will love to do it and she'll take over. And I said, yeah, you don't even need to do anything. It's going to be fine. I'll sort everything out. You just need to show up. But we were joking about it. And so she lives in France. And I remember she was like, we'll do the hen at home. So her mum, who suffered bad arthritis and stuff like that, could be there, and her sisters and me to have a dinner and whatever. And that day, someone had sent me a card describing Dad at the wedding, going, I had the most amazing conversation with your dad. He's so interesting. He's great. And like, I mean, what an amazing man. I wanted to tell you this experience because when you're getting married, you don't necessarily notice all the conversations that are going on. And it was the most beautiful card. And of course, I fell apart when I read it. And my friend happened to knock at the door and she was like, no, I just don't think you can come to this. She was like, why don't you? And I said, would it be better if I didn't? Do you think people are going to be uncomfortable? And she was like, no, Sarah would love to have you there, but I just think it's a lot. And I was like, no, I think I can be fine. I've gotten used to turning this on and off. I can just pop the mask on, I'll be grand. So we went out for dinner, and I think in a way that card was good because I had gotten a lot of emotion out. And then I went out for dinner. And again, it was like, no one can mention. Just don't mention it and everything will be fine. So no one did. And we got through dinner. I think there was definitely a slight bit of tension initially. I remember being very conscious of it and spending the first hour going, what have I done? I should have stayed home. But I wanted to show my friend that, no, it's going to be fine because we're going to have a whole weekend of this, and then we're going to have a wedding in Nice where she lives, and then we're going to have the Irish wedding back here, and I needed her to know I was going to be okay. So we got through it fine. Like, it went absolutely fine. Just managed to hold it together. Grant, the next day there was a lunch, there was a few things, it was a longer day, cocktail class that evening in Cafe and Zen. And I remember at about 9 just gone, it's so time to go home. Obviously, I was pregnant, so I couldn't even have a drink. Do you know the way, like, I remember my friend going, you did her proud. Like, you did the best you could and you didn't falter, and you definitely need to go home. And you're kind of done now until the wedding. Like, don't even make...
You've done your bit.
Yeah, there's no, you know... I remember saying to my husband that night, I fell apart the whole way home. I was like, there's nothing now. There's no more occasions. I'm not going to anything. I did what I needed to do for my friend, and I'm so glad I did it, but that's it. But I think what was worrying was I was developing this, like maybe a lot of people grieving, you know, that thing of, oh, actually, when I really want it, I can just switch this off. So maybe I'll just switch it off all the time. Maybe just grieving is just too hard. You know, it's too painful.
It's interesting what, you know, when you're saying at nighttime and stuff, and that almost wanting to do it in private, as you say.
Yeah.
And then there's like the fact that you were pregnant too.
Yeah.
It probably is a part to you. I mean, anyone in any sort of a pregnancy ever is terrified of losing the baby.
Yes.
And you're terrified of, if I do this, X could happen. And if I do that, X could happen. So maybe subconsciously there was a part of you going, you can't, you know, you have to hold things together.
Yeah.
And then you can sense the outside world.
Yeah.
I'm sure weeks later, are you okay now? And, you know, you need to mind yourself. I'm sure you're hearing that a lot.
Yeah.
As we would now, if we were looking at a pregnant woman, people like, watch her, mind her in the middle of a trauma.
Yeah. Make sure you eat. Make sure you do everything. Yeah. Normal. Yeah.
So maybe you felt this pressure as well of, I have to be fine. I can't make space for this. But it's the thing about it is it's like a tsunami. You can't stop it.
Oh, you can't.
And that's the thing. It was like bubbling up inside you all
the
time.
That's the thing.
As much as you fought it and were brave, you couldn't keep it in.
I think that's the amazing thing about counselling, because I think that's what counsellors will just tell you straight off the bat.
this is like a tsunami. You can try and compress it. And I remember more thinking of it, and that's not a nice analogy, but I remember thinking it's like a scab. If I don't pick at it, it'll be grand. It'll eventually just heal. If I just don't go near it, it'll fall off and it'll be grand. And it was like, I would love to say that 100% it was the pregnancy and the need to protect, obviously. And I definitely think there was an element, but I just think there was also an element of it just being so painful. I remember going into Holly Street, my consultant had suggested I saw the mental health nurse. And I remember going into her, I'd say it was like 2 months later. Like looking back now, it was madness. But it was the first time I had to tell someone what happened. Because everyone knew, you know, you go to a funeral, you go to removal, you know, your close friend, like everybody knows. It's the first time I had to sit down in front of a stranger and say these words. And I remember it took about 15 or 20 minutes. And she just sat there. And not that, I'm sure she deals with all sorts of really tough cases. I'd say she has one of the toughest jobs in the world. But I remember, I kind of remember her just sitting there and not kind of reacting. And I remember going, oh my God, I've never gone to counselling. This is torturous. There's no, you know, the way you just expect someone to come over and nearly hold your hand and go, it's okay. There just wasn't that. She, you know, obviously there's a level of professionalism. There's a level of maybe holding it together. I don't know. But I remember she just sat there and I just, and then I was getting more and more desperate to control myself because I thought there's no reaction here. I don't, you know, and she'd be like handing me tissues, but she probably knew I needed to get it out. But at the same time, I was like, I don't know if this is good for me or the baby. And then by the end of that session, I'd said about 5 sentences, I'd say. And she had me breathing into a paper bag. Like I couldn't, I had a complete convulsion. I couldn't, I had a total breakdown. And she was like, you're not ready. And it was like as if she'd been looking at the file going, who sent this woman to me? She is so not ready to talk about this.
No.
You don't do counselling for something as traumatic as that 2 months down the line. And my fear going into her was, is she going to mark me now as being unfit? Flag this one so the public health nurse knows when she calls to make sure she's not losing her mind when this baby arrives. Because he was due, we didn't know it was a boy, 6 months after. So it's not that long. And I remember thinking, oh God, I kind of really need to hold it together. And I actually think that was the biggest problem. And that's where I really fell down, was going, mask has to go on and it has to stay on. Like, I mean, as if you can't just turn it on and off. I say the consultant, to be honest, our GP, our family GP, had referred me to that consultant when I went for the pregnancy test to confirm the pregnancy. And he had said, I will let him know. So he knew. And I'd say then,
which
I came in.
Caring and.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh no, he was like, he was our family doctor for years. And the consultant, I suppose, would have been remiss not to kind of go, we really should check this patient out, make sure she, you know, but I just think the timing of it wasn't right. But then we're on a clock. Baby's coming. What do you do? I don't know. Like what? I don't blame anyone for that. I look back and I go, yeah, I definitely wasn't ready. And I think, to be honest, in hindsight, she was looking at the file going, this person's not ready. And then in I come, an absolute train wreck in front of her. And she's going, don't come back to me.
Yeah.
You know, you're not ready. And she was right. I wasn't, you know.
No one's fault, as you say.
Yeah.
But it's like they kind of had to. But then you can see why she didn't respond either, because you didn't, I suppose, willingly go, I'm coming to you because I really need to come to you. And she probably could see that.
Yeah.
And so the whole relationship is off from the start then, isn't
it? That's it. Oh, it's like, the appointment's been made and here's your letter in the post. And you just show up and it's not like you proactively reach out. Because
I then had to tell her, even though it wasn't within you to want to go and tell someone.
Exactly.
So I suppose from there.
Yeah.
You're pregnant and baby arrives.
Yeah, so Christmas Day, I'll never forget it.
Christmas Day?
No, he didn't arrive on Christmas Day. Sorry. We had my mum and brother over and I remember thinking there was something going on with the waters. And I was like, it was only a little bit. And I was like, I won't get into any detail, obviously. But I was like, I think something's going on. And I'd been in with the consultant 2 days beforehand and his exact words to me were, if I was a betting man, I'd say he'd go over. And sure, my mom had gone over on me and, you know, and I was like, oh yeah, I'd imagine so. But he was big. He was measuring big. So he was 8 pounds 8, 10 days early. And I remember being in a bit of a tizzy going, oh gosh, now I hope he doesn't go way over or he's going to be bigger and bigger. You know, I was getting really stressed about the birth because I hadn't given time to hypnobirthing. I was not in the headspace. So I was kind of going into this a little bit on the back foot because I was dealing with so much else, obviously. Looking back, that was just carnage. But like, anyway, I rang, we had our dinner, we had mum and Alan over for dinner. And I thought, I'm not going to, you know, they didn't necessarily want to be at home. We wanted to have them. And Kieran was like, I'll do all the cooking. My mum got stuck in. It was lovely. And then after, I was like, I need to ring Hollis Street and just go, I think there might be, you know. And they were like, oh, if there's anything but waters, it could be a slow burner. So yeah, there could be infection if you don't, you have to come in. So I went in on Christmas evening and they said, no, 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 no. And I was like, no, I'm convinced something. So anyway, the next day, Stephen's Day evening, mom and Alan went home. We got through our first Christmas without dad, which was a huge one. And I'll never forget my husband going, let's get pizza and watch a movie now. The house to ourselves, let's just relax. And now we need to get ready for this baby. Now we need to get mentally ready, you know. And I was on maternity leave now at this point. And I was like, yeah, I've got like probably 2 weeks now. This is great. And then 6 o'clock the next morning, I woke up, waters went, in we went. And Sean was born after a very traumatic and difficult birth at 5 o'clock that evening.
Tell me, if you don't mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you find it quite easy to bond to Sean straight away?
Yes, I did. I was worried about that. I had said to that nurse, and I remember saying it and going, oh, you absolute idiot. Why would you say that? I remember saying to her, I'm worried if it's a boy and he looks like my dad, I don't know how I'm going to cope. And I remember thinking, like, there may as well be just this big, you know, flashing light when Sean was born going, oh, no. I was really worried about that. But like, he was the image of my dad for about, I'd say about a week.
Was he?
And now. Then, no, he doesn't look anything like my dad. He's the image of my husband and his family, his dad. I have photos of him where we look back and we go, it's hard to believe that's actually Sean. He just was the image of my dad. But I got comfort from that.
Yeah.
I remember my sister going, oh, I didn't want to say it to you. And I was like, I said, I think it's magic. He's with us, which is what we want. Yeah.
He's
really,
part of him.
Yeah. And I'm
genetically like he's a descendant.
Of course, exactly. So and it, you lovely. Know, if there's the ability to be around people when you've passed or if you can be some sort of guide, then maybe he's Sean's guy. You know, so I got comfort from that. Mm. So I suppose fast forward to about 4 months after he's born, he's reflux, he's colic. It was honestly the roughest 4 months. I remember just being like, oh my God, I can't grieve. I can't even, you know, and I was very wrongly, in reflection, very much like I don't want any negativity around Sean. I want him born into a family where I didn't want him born under a cloud of sadness and darkness. But it probably wasn't healthy. I didn't mind when it was just more our house. I just didn't want everyone come to our house and falling apart, which is ridiculous. But I suppose if I can blame that a little bit on postpartum hormones and just wanting a happy environment for your baby. But I think looking back, it probably was ridiculous. But anyway, that didn't last too long, but it was just the early days. But about 4 months later, we were in a good place. We'd gotten the reflux sorted. We got the colic sorted. And I just loved being a mom. I just loved it. I still do love it. Obviously, will for the rest of my life. But I was on cloud nine a little bit. I was like, this is great now. And we just focus on Sean and we just won't think about anything. And the 1 year anniversary was coming up and the coroner's court was coming up. And I remember my husband sitting me down going, I think it might be time to think about maybe a bit of counselling. What do you think? You know, would it be a good time? I think they were all worried about me going back off maternity leave, back into work, and then maybe not being able to manage everything. And I think there was this thing definitely within my family, You gotta kind of talk through a lot of this and we gotta kind of handle it by talking through it. So there is no option to just, you know, bury this, which is what I absolutely wanted. Didn't want anything more than to bury it. I want to remember dad. I've always been like that. I want to remember dad. I don't want to remember how he died. But to get past how he died and accept it, I knew I needed to get through it. And I had a lot of working through to do. So he wasn't wrong. But then we got hit with a bombshell. Well, I did. About a month after dad died, two of his best friends had come to the house and told my mom that at this family occasion with the photo that I was referring to, that one of them had phoned him and potentially interrupted him. He basically told her, you potentially have saved my life. I was going to do this. I can't believe what I was thinking. And they told my mom and my brother about a month after, I don't even know if it was a month after the funeral. And then Kieran was like, everybody was raging, but he was like, you can't tell Lynn, she'll go mental if she thinks somebody knew something as concrete as there was an attempt. And he was quite clear about it, you know. I think the next day he'd gone to their house and talked to them and said, oh, I don't know what I was thinking. I would never do that. I would never do that to my mom and, you know, the kids, Dolores and the kids. I would never, ever do that. And he convinced them that this was just a blip and this would never happen. And then they kind of said to him, would you think about maybe going into PATS, or would you think about maybe getting help? And we can tell from his iPad that he had looked that up, and for whatever reason. But we also discovered that he'd stopped taking his antidepressants after, which makes so much sense and would explain why he wasn't being lifted the way, not that it's a silver bullet, not that it's, you know, but just that usually there would be an increase in mood, or if not, then you look at the dosage, you look at, you know, but there wasn't really an increase in mood, and he was anti-taking them, but we never considered that he had just stopped, because that's the one thing you can't do. That was a huge bombshell. I was so, like, I didn't know what to do with that. And I remember going to the counsellor and she was like, hang on, this is brand new information now. So we're dealing with something that happened almost a year ago, but now we're dealing with new information about something that happened, you know, before her dad passed. So we had to get our heads around that, figure out. You know, I don't blame anyone. Different people in my family, we probably have different views on it, maybe. But like, I know Dad would have not wanted anyone carrying the weight of what he did. But it's frustrating, you know, because he'd like to think someone would say, let's tell the family and make it, and we'll suffer the consequences of him being annoyed later. That's what I kind of would be thinking. I actually looked it up at the time, and I remember going, what's the advice if someone tells you they are and then that they're not? What do you do? And it's like a lot centered around if you think someone might be suicidal, but it doesn't talk about, you know, the fact that sometimes people are telling you the truth and they want your help, and then they've decided they're going to go it alone. And I think that needs to be talked about. And I think particularly with younger people, where TikTok trends and really scary things are going on, you really need to know it's not a decision you can make on your own, that you should really go to someone in the family unless you feel that's not a good idea for whatever reason, and allow them. We would have had Dad in to Pat's, and we would have had him. I'm not saying he'd still be here today, because he may not. My brother went on to become a mental health nurse, and he's in the UK now, and he would tell you it's not, you know, sometimes this can still happen even after you've sought treatment and help, and, you know, but the fact that he told someone, I feel like he put trust by telling them that. And he had gone missing for a few hours at that family event, and we were ringing him, and I remember getting really worked up and wanting to go to the house. He was feeding the dog apparently, and he was gone for ages, and I remember, and it was later I went, this all makes sense, this all ties in with what they're saying now. And my husband wanted to come with me, and I remember just when Dad came back in, I was like, what happened? And he was like, oh, I just caught up in time. But he wasn't answering me the way he normally would. He was a bit vacant. And I remember thinking, he was like, I'm just really tired. And I was like, okay, well, so why don't you just go home and, you know, say goodnight and go home? But like, imagine coming back to an event after something like that and then having to try and hold it together. You know, it was just... So at that point,
dealing with that
in itself, yeah.
Just take a moment.
Yeah.
Like, that's very difficult for you to put all those pieces of a puzzle together. Of course, it was like another blow, because you then revisit it and go, and it's kind of scary and it's shocking, because you just never think or know that's what was happening.
No. It kind of looks now like,
known, like
it might have been more obvious because of everything I've described. But when you're living through it,
you
not.
You can't know.
Yeah, you just can't.
And you can look at people and be like, are you okay?
Yeah.
But you can never
see what they're really thinking.
And that's, I understand why you're upset, because he actually did tell someone.
Yeah.
No, I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess, and, as you say, there is a conversation to be had about, and it is big information to receive. What do you do with that when you find out?
That's it. And do people don't? I'm not sure.
No, of course they don't. I don't.
Yeah.
Nobody's trained and they don't know.
No, no.
But, you know, one time a woman said to me, this was her take on it. She'd lost her husband to suicide. And she said, it's like cancer. If you catch it early, you can treat it.
Yeah.
But if someone said to you, I'm after finding a lump on my breast or something.
Yeah.
They go, okay, well, we won't tell anyone.
Yeah.
Just imagine. You know what I mean? You'd really encourage them and follow up.
Seek help, and be proactive.
Yeah.
Now, I don't doubt they grilled him, and I don't doubt that he convinced them. And I, you know, but it was so unfair to my mum and brother. And my sister, who was obviously told as well at the same time, when they found out this has happened and we weren't sure whether to tell you, but we've decided to tell you. Like, what does my mum do with that? Yeah, I'm glad we know, because I'm the kind of person who would want to know the detail.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, it was a nightmare.
It didn't really help, though.
No, it didn't help. No. You'd have to wonder, like, if you're looking at it outside of me, from a bird's eye view, looking down, from the outside.
Why?
Why would you, you know? But I think it just shows where he clearly, it wasn't like he decided on this one day. He was clearly going back and forth, which is really hard to kind of take, you know?
But it just opens up more questions, because you think, was there another day where he didn't tell anyone?
But see, this is it.
Your mind obviously goes to all other places.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
So I suppose we'll go back to, you're with Sean and you get this news. How do you then, let's say when you get to the anniversary and stuff, how are you doing? Do you go to counselling your husband was suggesting?
I did. Yeah. We went to Console. So Console in Dublin.
Oh, yeah, they're gone now.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, that wasn't. The counsellor was an absolute dote. I loved her. It was so sad what happened. It was a really special space for people grieving. It was really, the way it was even in a home, it was just lovely the way they did it. It was really nice. It was very tough, obviously. She had this policy where she's like, I won't let you go home with makeup streamed all down your face. I'll make sure we clean you up before we go. You know, she tried so hard to make it a thing that I never wanted to not go back to. You know, she was like, we're going to talk about it. It's going to be tough. But she used to always say that to me. She's like, every time you come to me and you get through something, you're chipping away at it. You're creating a tunnel of, I won't say clarity, but you can see the light at the end of the tunnel. But you have to get through it. You have to get it out, because if you bury it, it'll bury you. And I remember going, yeah, okay, I've got the point. She wasn't wrong. But then I went, and then Consuelo went. And then we moved to London. So an opportunity came up for my husband he has his own business, to move to London for 2 years. And I wanted to go. And I was torn, because I didn't know how my mom was going to take it. And to her credit, she was amazing. She was like, look, I am sad. I am, you know, grandson now, he's going, you know. But my family were massively supportive. They were just afraid. My mom was afraid I'd live there forever and would want to come back, but that didn't happen. So we went. And then I didn't do anything with any kind of grief. I don't remember what we were doing for the anniversaries. I don't think I did all that much. I think I was in my little happy bubble with my family away. Two of my best friends live there. I was like,
new start.
This is grand. Yeah. New start, fresh start, chance to kind of get away from, you know, all the reminders that there are at home. Sorry, we had had, in the interim, we'd had a horrendous experience with the coroner's court. So that ended up being a trigger for a couple of things later on. I actually complained to the coroner whose deputy was presiding. It was one of the worst experiences of, like, that you could have as a family bereaved in this way. She was just massively unempathetic, if that's a word. Like, she was just so not, she kept bringing up, you know, really difficult details and picking them out, like we were talking about numbers and maths, and it was just so clinical. It was just so, like, and then this, on what time was that? Oh, right, okay. And there was just, my mom was
traumatized. Like we had to, she had to leave the room and vomit and come back in. Like it was absolutely horrendous. I remember the person, you know, I don't know, I've forgotten what they're called. The lady was taking the notes. Like she was looking at me and looking back as much as to go, this never happens. I don't know what's going on. There was just, it was just, then she wants to have an open verdict. And I'm a real person, if there's rules and if there's a decision and court says this or this, like I'd be one of those people that, okay, that's the final. But I remember just going, I cannot leave here. We cannot leave here as a family with an open verdict when it's crystal clear what happened. Why would there be? And I, to this day, I don't remember her rationale, but she did a complete 360 and went back and went, okay. So I'll mark it down. And we were just like, what was the point of this whole impartial process? So I complained to the coroner and he had gone off and spoken to people who were in the room, including the guard, I believe, and then came back and said, I'm really sorry that this was handled so badly. That was going, so going to the UK was just a breath of fresh air. I missed my family. They all came over. I remember saying to mom, great, you had to come over and it'd be somewhere different for you to go and a different, you know. So that all went great. And then we decided we'll try for number two. Happened easy in the first time, naively thought we would sail through to having a second child. And I had an ectopic pregnancy and lost a tube and there was all of that going on. And we moved home a month later to a new house that we were trying to, so a new build and there's all that going on and, you know, trying to make decisions on finishes of tiles and all that kind of stuff. And then the anniversary was in the UK and I remember thinking, this is the last anniversary that I'm going to get away with just me remembering Dad in a private way. You know, once you go home, it becomes a different thing. And I came home and I'd say the 6 months that followed were one of the worst 6 months actually. Because I think it was like, oh, you're home now. This is great. And I just remember, not that I didn't want to be home. It was great to be around family. But I remember just going, oh God, all of the stuff that I've tried not to think about is just, you know, fronting. Right there, front and central, needs to be handled. And I started going off down the fertility. Right, okay, this has happened. I need to check the other tubes. You know, all of the medical pieces. And then it came to the first anniversary that, so this would have been the 5 year anniversary. And I left work on a half day and the normal bus I get back, I live in Ashburn now, Mead, to get home doesn't run at the same time. I had to pass the coroner's court and I got on the bus at Bussaris and I was messing with my mom going, so what do we do? Will I go over to you? What do you, you know? She was like, Lynn, to be honest, I actually don't think you should. I think we're both not good. Like I was fighting back tears in the bus. It was just, I just hated the anniversary with a passion and I just want to remember Dad the way he was. And I remember going home and going, okay, that's grand. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to pick Sean at Burley. We're going to go to the Phoenix Park. It was a really sunny day. I was running snacks, the dog into the car, you know, going, this is grand. I'll just bypass this whole thing. And I remember feeling really unwell. I was like, why don't I feel well? What's wrong with me? And went out the door, collected him, brought him home, had to go back to the house, didn't feel well. I was like, what'll I do? He's all like, we're going to the park. You know, he's 4 and a half. So he's all like, yay, we're going to the park, about to start school in the September. And went to go to the park and had to pull into a service station. I was just completely, I actually to this day don't know what happened. Next, all I know is I had to get out of the car, I had to crack all the windows for the dog. It was a really hot day. Bring Sean in, go up to the bathroom. I hate public toilets. Like I don't go unless I really have to. Like
really
like if I'm in like a really nice restaurant or somewhere like that. Yeah, I can't abide like so. So I remember coming out of the cubicle and sitting at the top of the steps in the service station and this man passed me on the way up. And Sean's fluting around with the, you know, the button on the lift and I'm going, I don't touch anything. But I'm not able to kind of, it felt like it wasn't me. I can't describe it. It was like, I was going to faint, but I wasn't. I don't know. The man who had then obviously used the bathroom walked past me and he said, are you okay? And I said, I really don't feel well, but I don't know what's wrong. And then I started to not be able to kind of comprehend what was happening. And then I thought, well, I'm going to faint. But you can't faint when you're sitting. So I thought maybe she'll stand up and faint and then that'll be it, you know. And I know that sounds bizarre, but I couldn't explain how I felt. And I'm like, I don't know what's happening. And I was sweating. Like I remember just, I'm not like,
I'm just not someone who would sweat a huge amount normally unless, you know, I'm like pressure exam or something. And I remember just feeling like I really feel really unwell. Like there's no way I'm going to be able to drive home. And he was like, is there someone I can call? And I couldn't say Kieran's number. I couldn't. Everything was starting to go woozy. Like I was going to faint. And he said, here, give me your phone. And he, you know, right in Grant. I said, Kieran, rang him. Kieran came. Collect Sean, the dog, me, bring us home, and then bring Sean off for an ice cream. He said, get into bed. You need to just get this out. And I think from there, I was like, yeah, this is kind of a massive issue. Like, I'm really trying to fight against something that's just too powerful to fight against. Like, why am I trying to fight this? I just have to face it. So then I went back to counselling, and then COVID hit. And that was kind of the end of counselling. There wasn't really the option to do a face-to-face online thing. So I think at that point, though, I had gone through enough counselling here and there. It doesn't sound like, but, you know, there were months of it each time to kind of go, okay, I wasn't angry at Dad at all. It was the total opposite. I just had to find acceptance and peace with the decision he made, which I now have as much as I think you can have it. I'm now more in the kind of in that space of, you know, shouldn't have happened. I wish it hadn't happened. I wish we'd known. I wish we'd gotten him help. But I can't change what happened because I didn't know. And we have to move forward. He wouldn't want us to be. It's the last thing he would have wanted is for us to carry this.
So you're now back in Ireland and you've had this realization really that it's just too much.
Yeah.
And all of this is running alongside. So you're obviously trying for a baby. How long is this happening for? Been a couple of years?
It's been kind of three and a half years now. Yeah.
Okay. So you're 3.5 years trying.
Yeah.
Nothing's happening.
Yeah.
And kind of what's your next step then where you leave, I suppose, the natural route and do you then go to seek help?
So it was, I remember it was 2020 and COVID-19 had just obviously kicked off at the end of 2019. And I remember going into, actually we had our first egg collection just as everything was shut down, like to the point where the fertility clinics were even like, we know we have to operate, but right now the legislation isn't in place. So we need to kind of, I had just had an egg collection and I had OHSS is basically when your ovaries are completely filled with fluid and they're not draining properly and it's dangerous. So they were like, look, if anything happens, just go into an emergency room. But the reality is we're getting nowhere fast. We had a miscarriage after that, transfers, years more fertility treatment going on. So that's a long time. But the piece about grief and fertility was really interesting because it was only when I went to Reiki with a friend of mine that it became clear to me that, you know, like I knew I couldn't keep fighting it, but it was there. It was manifest. Like it was there in my body. The blockages were there. The energy couldn't flow. It was when she explained to me, like, you can do everything that you're doing. I had left my career at this point. I had gone out on my own for a year and done a ton of research. I was doing oxygen therapy with people that were having limbs about to be amputated. Like I was just going to town. I was in Greece. I was having this done, that done, red light therapy. I could write a book on the stuff that I did to try and get me into a good place before our fourth and final round. But it was the Reiki, I think, that was a huge part of that. So one is getting your eggs into a good place despite age. And then the other is actually clearing the blockages, getting rid of all the baggage emotionally, which is something like I have a fertility group, a very small group that I just do a Zoom every month with the girls after I share my stories and people reach out. And I thought, let's get together and just have a space where people can talk because you cover everything else in other ways, but this is missing. And people don't get that the cumulative trauma of all these losses and 7 years of trying for years on end.
So tell me then, I'm cutting into you now because I want to pick your brain a bit.
Yeah.
And not just skim past it. Yeah. I want to give it space.
Yeah.
7 years.
Yeah.
Of trying.
Yeah.
And longing for another baby.
Yeah.
and grief on one side of your life running concurrently with everything.
Yeah.
How did that affect you?
It's just, it depletes you. You end up with nothing. Like you're kind of lonely because I think as well, when it goes on for so long, your friends have finished nearly having their kids. So you kind of start to become the ones with the one shot, like, and there are plenty of couples with no children, but you become the ones where it's like, oh God, you know, maybe we won't mention that. Or, you know, it just becomes apparent. I was very open about it. I remember thinking, everyone knows anyway. They're going to know we would have liked more kids, I'm sure. So I was very open about it, but it's tough. I didn't even tell, like, I don't think we even told our family the first round, the second round, and then getting into the third round, I remember going, I need the support. It's so hard. And my family were devastated for us. Like, we'd been through so much. So I think, but do you know what? I on our fertility group last night, I had someone speaking who helped me massively. She's really into mindset and reflexology and stuff. And she was just like, it's just, nobody looks at the trauma and the grief and all of these things in conjunction with the medical side with, and you can't not look at that. But she was like, I really believe if the desire is there and there's a baby there, you're trying to call it in. Like, she really feels strongly about that. And so do I. And I remember thinking lessons had to be learned before our little girl arrived. I think, like, things had to be cleared. Things had to be kind of made way for her arrival. And I know that sounds a little bit kind of off the wall. And people listening to this might think that's mad. But I just think, you know, I know it's upsetting revisiting it, but I'm in a much better place than I was 2 years ago even. And I think it's because of that. It's letting it go. It's letting it clear. It's getting acceptance and realizing that you're never not going to have sadness about the person you've lost. But you have to focus on them. You have to think back to who they were. The how is what you have to get through. When it's sudden death, or when it's a traumatic death, or a tragic death, or where someone else is responsible, or something like that. That's really, really, really tough. But once you get through that, there is light. And the light is you grieve, like, I won't say, you know, everyone else, because lots of people have very traumatic stories, as you well know. But I think there's a layer of grief that you have to get through. And it's not just remembering someone who passed on when they were older that had a good life. And you can go, look, there's a lot of great things. They lived a great life. They lived to a great age. When you don't have that, you have to get through all of this first. And fighting it is probably the worst thing I ever did. But that was a lesson I had to learn. I had to learn that I had to stop fighting it and get through it and not be afraid of it.
Mm. So the loss of your father was really impacting you.
Yeah.
Physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, yeah. every which way. You were carrying it.
Yeah.
And it was unresolved for you.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then also, there is grief and loss separate to your dear dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the losses and the miscarriages and the failed IVF.
Yeah. That's it.
Do you feel like that was blocking and is something that you needed to work through as well? And how hard is it to do that when you're still in a, does it become so medical? Like, okay, that one didn't work. Let's move to the next one. Is there no space to grieve?
No, this is one of the things I feel really, 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 really passionate about. When you're in it, I remember the doctor after the first miscarriage saying it's a normal outcome of human reproduction. Or something that you have miscarriage. Now, at the time, I remember going, yeah. And I remember looking at my husband going,
could you be any more clinical?
Don't react. This is how it is. This is just how it is. We just have to accept it. But yeah, when you're in it, I think for me, the hardest loss was the ectopic because they had to remove the tube. It's just treated like a surgery. And I had a horrific experience that morning going in with a taxi driver. You won't believe this. He asked me if I was going to visit someone in the hospital and I said, no, I have to be admitted because I had a suitcase in the car and he was probably wondering, I don't know why I told him. But I said, no, I'm actually losing the pregnancy. I didn't want to get into it, but he asked me why I was going in and I didn't know what else to say. So I just told him the truth. And he says, so it's kind of like an abortion. And I said, no, it's not like an abortion at all. Like, this is 5 years of wanting to have another baby. And then the cruelest thing in the world, it implants in a tube. It can never grow in a tube, but it still was growing. And they were getting really worried, going, this is an emergency. You need to come in like at 8 o'clock in the morning and the tube needs to be removed. And no one mentioned what was in the tube. They just said operation was a success. The tube is gone. And I remember just thinking, really?
Is anyone going to mention the baby?
No one mentioned the baby. That's a piece of trauma I definitely hold on to. That came up. That's been coming up a lot for me over the last few years. But like that, it's like, okay, I'm down a tube. And that was the start of all our problems.
Can I also ask then?
Yeah.
There's also a part of you who, so if that's not a successful pregnancy and you lose that baby,
yeah,
but you lose a tube,
yeah,
does that reduce your chances,
yeah,
then? So you're now, do you start, hope is obviously a big word for people who are trying to conceive. Did you struggle with hope?
Oh,
were you losing hope?
Absolutely. Because here's the thing that most people probably realistically think is your chances are halved. But that was my dominant ovary. So we had to then take medication to try and really boost ovulation. Most of us have a dominant ovary. We probably don't even realize it. But if you have ovulation pain and you know you're ovulating, you can start to track it. Pain's not good. You're not supposed to feel pain. I used to love it because I was like, now I know I'm ovulating. And now I know it's this side. And I used to track it. But my chances were way lower than 50%. So losing that tube was the start of like IVF, basically, because there's no way we were like, I remember him saying to me, there could be 3 months out of 12 in a year when you can try. But if it takes a year for a healthy couple to conceive, sure, you'd be going for 3-4 years. Like, there's no way.
And also not to, you know, offend, but I'm conscious of people tuning in.
Yeah.
And age.
Yeah.
Is something that's
absolutely
fine telling someone that's 21.
Absolutely. 100%.
Was that a big,
massive
shadow in
a
this whole thing?
Huge. Like, to the point where all the stuff I did with oxygen therapy, red light therapy, like I could write it, honestly, and I've read so many books, no toxins, plastic's gone, no nail varnish, no this, no that, no drinking, no nothing. It becomes kind of miserable. And then you obviously have everything else on top of it. So you've no vices. You're missing out nights out. You don't want to go anywhere. You're making excuses. It just compounds the kind of isolation. But to put it in context, I remember when I turned 40 and we're heading into all of this, my friend, he was married with 3 kids, super healthy, like just unreal. And she messaged me just after I turned 40 to say she'd cancer. And we lost her. So it'll be her 5-year anniversary soon. But that's all during COVID. So we can't go. We can't see her. We can't travel. Everything's locked down. She lives in Brussels. We can't even get there. And I remember thinking, you know, and I remember talking to her about it because she was like, I know you do a lot of positive thinking and I know you're trying to, you know, turn the lack of hope into hope. And I know you're doing a lot of work on that. And I remember her going, what do you do? And tell me what you do with the gratitude journal, even when everything's going wrong. And one thing for hope for people over a certain age, I will say you can get a handle on your egg quality in 3 months. And 100% you can. And you can reverse a lot of damage that might have been done because it takes 3 months for eggs to come to fruition, basically, you know, in terms of ovulating. So there's a lot you can do. And I remember when we went to our doctor, a woman on our 4th attempt, she said, you mention age a lot. I want you to put that a bit to one side because with all the stuff you've done and all the stuff you're taking, there's like, I cut out loads of foods. I can't even tell you. It was so extensive. It was crazy. I never felt better though. She was like, you're in a good place, but I think you've immune issues. I think that's why you've never conceived naturally apart from that one time. And your son, obviously. And she said, I think there's a lot we can do around that.
You know, touching on that doctor there, and she's like, put your age to one side.
Yeah.
Fantastic to hear.
Amazing.
I know of people who have gone into a doctor and they've been like, yeah, no, you're in failure. You know, you're in ovarian failure.
Yeah.
So stark and book closed.
Yeah.
And what that can do to a person is like, you hear stories all the time where they're told you'll never conceive, you'll never this, you'll never that. And it's wrong sometimes.
Yeah.
So like, to have someone like that, do you believe as well, like, that, I guess, you had the right people with you? Or did you encounter people along the way that gave you no hope?
Our very final round in the same IVF clinic that we did the first 3 rounds with, we got on a call. We're supposed to have the call. And just to keep it succinct, but to say, he joined late. We were ringing reception going, have we got the right time? You know, he comes on the call. He was the guy who told us at the beginning, you have a baby already, so chances are you have better than average odds, whatever. Three rounds later, no real changes in protocol. I challenged him on it. I said, you know, you don't check vitamin D. It's essential for implantation. Oh, we live in a country in Ireland where everyone's low on vitamin D. And I said, yeah, but we also live in a country where some women will get pregnant no matter what's going on. There are women in Gaza who conceived during what's going on there. The reality is some women will conceive no matter what, vitamin D or no vitamin D. And then there's people like me who are already challenged in some way with, you know, and you're not even checking it. And by the end of it, he basically told me that I need to go and do some yoga and accept that this probably was never going to happen. And it was on that call, my husband, I thought my husband, who's so level-headed and so calm, was going literally, if we'd been in front of him, I just don't know. I think he would have got up and walked out. We ended the call. And it was at that point that I said, I'm going to take a year out and I'm going to prove him wrong. And I'm going to get all this stuff and I'm going to do all this stuff I've been reading about. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And I don't believe he did.
Come here. That's a terrifying prospect.
Yeah.
Because do you know how many people probably sat in front of like him and gave up?
Yeah. I also know, I'll tell you what I know. When you want another baby and you're gutsy and you're determined and you have to be ready for people like that. You have to keep going. Because here's the thing. I believe, I knew in my heart of hearts, I deep down, I wavered a lot, but deep down, I knew there was another baby there for us. And I was at the point now where I went, okay, 30 grand later, we've wasted, but I now know he's not the way to go. And I had to learn all of that, which I shouldn't have had to.
It's just, you know, I'm questioning you on it because I know of people in my life who've come across people like that. Yeah. And that's fine again, but when, I hate the phrase like when the clock is ticking. Oh.
Yeah.
But like I'm saying, when time is of the essence.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like that's, it's not good because you have to get somewhere else quick.
That's the problem. And I think with him, he told us we were a difficult case. He said, when he was late on the call, he said, oh, sorry, all my difficult cases are on a Thursday.
But even those words.
Imagine using that word to someone.
But it's like, harmful.
Yeah, oh, it is.
Because then as a woman, especially the woman, you're going home going, I'm a difficult case.
Yeah.
And, you know, that you're internalizing that language.
Absolutely. It's so damaging. But what was really interesting about that was when we got on a consultation with two other clinics and one of the clinics, I said to the consultant, you know, look, I know we're a difficult case and I know time is ticking. I think that's where she went, okay, I want you to park the time. But she said to me, most people who come to me are difficult cases. She just embraced it.
You wouldn't be in front of me if it wasn't difficult.
She's like, I specialize in immune issues and difficult cases. But she wasn't, I think you have to develop, I know this is going to sound really tough, but you do have to develop a bit of a tough skin and go, I'd rather hear it straight from someone. And she was like, I don't see why we won't get there. So let's park the age. You've done all this amazing stuff. Let's and she was really amazing.
Just keep like, going until
let's keep going. And we did one round with her. I said, I've never had a fresh transfer. So we've only ever had.
Sorry, was she a new woman after?
Yeah, so she was branching away from another clinic at the time when I started looking at Greece and different places.
You had three attempts in a previous clinic.
Three cycles and lots of transfers among that, so more than three. Yeah
And then you changed. So tell me about the fourth transfer.
It was just night and day. I contacted her a month before our egg collection here in Galway and I said to her, I read the study. Now I say I was a nightmare for her in a way, although I think we got on great, but I'd say she was like, oh, this one now is going to be pulling out studies. And I just said, look, it says vitamin D, blah, blah, blah. It's just come out today. And we already knew about vitamin D, but this was a brand new study. And I was going away on holidays. And this is how flexible she was. I was like, I know you're working with Galway and I know there's another layer here because you don't have the lab in Dublin, but could we postpone a month? And she went, I've read the study. That was the other thing. The others had never read anything that I was sending them. And I wasn't a nightmare. I didn't annoy them. It was only when it came up she said to me, I think that's a great idea. I think let's do that. You'd be more relaxed. And I said, yeah, that's great. And then I said to her, I don't want to test the embryos. I've done my own research. I'm not. And I argued that with her, but she was like, oh, the age and the embryo being normal, the chances. And I said, I really don't want to test. And I said, and I take full responsibility if it's an abnormal embryo and we transfer, but we're only going to get a couple at my age. So I don't believe in it. I just don't, for my own personal reason. And it's very personal, and everybody's different reasons that they might do it. But I just thought, yeah, I had spoken to a few people and I was like, no, I'm not convinced it's the way to go. People who really know their stuff. And she said, okay, we'll do a fresh transfer.
So you do the transfer in Galway?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you do a transfer?
Yeah.
Okay. So then you have to sit and wait to see if it worked. Is that how it goes?
The egg collection was done. Yeah.
Egg collection in Galway.
On the Saturday. Whatever day it was. And then you have to wait day 3, day 5.
Yes.
Whatever happens on day 5 is key. And then on day 5 is the same day you do your transfer if it's fresh.
Okay.
So I'm traveling to Galway that morning.
They tell you how many embryos have survived to day 5. Yeah. How many?
So 2.
It was 2.
Just 2.
Then they say, do you get the choice of implanting 2?
Yes, but I was nervous about that in case the environment wasn't right and both were gone.
So you did 1?
1. But as you're driving to Galway, you're waiting for a call from the lab to say maybe this 5th one isn't fully there. So they promised me they'd phone me nice and early, but they'd only know at a certain point. So we're literally halfway to Galway. And then I think, right, there's no call. That's good. And then we get to Galway and they're like, okay, yeah, this one's looking really good. There's 2, amazing, but this one's looking really good.
So you get to Galway.
Yeah.
They do the...
the transfer.
Yeah. Transfer, they call it.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
And then you go off home.
So my doctor wanted to be back in at about day 10. Ideally, you should wait till day 10 to do bloods. And I tested that morning before I went into her because I just couldn't face the bad news. And it's a very funny story, but anyway, it was positive. I didn't know that my husband checked the sample when I was gone, even though I told him not to. And he rings me on the M50 going, take it handy. There's precious cargo on board. And I was like, I can't believe you're telling me this on the M50. I can't tell you how happy I was.
You're on the M50?
Yeah.
By the way, how many years later is this?
7.
7 years later.
7 years later. So my son is now 9. Yeah. So 2 years after he was
born.
Oh, like just ecstatic. Ecstatic, but I know it's an awful thing to say. I was kind of at the point where I was like, no, this is our time now. Like I was actually really positive about it. And I remember thinking, like with Sean, first time around when we lost Dad, I'm not going to lose this baby. I actually kind of felt safe going, I felt like someone was watching over me going, no, this is going to be okay. And I felt like that again this time. But we went in to get the bloods done to confirm it. And it turned out that we had immune issues. So my white blood count was racing, which is not unusual when you have immune issues. And she then had to do all sorts to kind of pull it back. And then I remember her sitting us down at this about week 8, 9. And she said, okay, we need to try this radical drug. It's not in Ireland. We need to get it in. And it's €3,000. And we need it in the next 24 hours to keep your white blood count under control, or it can damage, the pregnancy could be gone. So right up to 12, 14 weeks, we were still, but once we got to 12 weeks, the placenta took over and then we were done.
So tell me who arrived.
Keila. Little, she's just magic.
What
she's
was
amazing.
That like welcoming her into the world?
It was a section, it was totally different. And I remember speaking to the anesthesiologist who was behind us. And of course, they're asking loads of questions. Did you do for the children? How old are they? And then she got a brief synopsis. I was like, 9-year-old, we've been waiting 7 years. And she was like, oh, what do you do for a living? I was like, I'm a photographer. She said, do you have your phone? I said, yeah. And she said, okay, give it to me. And she was behind my shoulder. And we literally have snap, 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 snap of Keila literally coming out. It is unbelievable and is so different from first time. She literally, you can see our consultant lifting her up. Like literally, she must have taken 100 photos. And there she was, Dad. Again, I was like, I don't believe how like Dad she is. And then as soon as I was up in the ward with her, she was back to not looking like my dad. But that gave me massive comfort again. And she was just, from the moment she arrived, she's just been magic. Like she's just such a character. She's brilliant. And Sean adores her. Adores her. Adores her. You should see her, the squeals when she hears him coming. It's just like, honestly, I don't regret a minute of it. It was all worth it. I learned a lot along the way, but there's so much improvement in Ireland for fertility as well. But I'm so grateful and I just want to pay it forward. So that's why I host the group with the girls, just to feel heard.
So you host a fertility group now?
Yeah, it's just a small group.
And you also left that job and you are now a newborn photographer?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're like a friend of mine. I was telling you off air who
was in a stressful accountant's job, and now she's a family photographer.
That's
and
it.
Very meaningful.
It is meaningful because you come at it from a totally different perspective when you change career.
Yeah.
Because you want to be there.
Yeah.
You know, I see people coming in and obviously it can be hard with a newborn and maybe toddlers into the bar, you know, and I always say to them, you'll never get this, but I know it's tough because I'm still in the middle of it. Like, she's not even two, but it's magic having your kids all together and being photographed. And the amount of clients I've had come in with, you know, who've also had a journey. A lot of people have had journeys that you wouldn't realize, you know. Yeah.
And you.
Yeah.
How are you doing today with the grief and everything? And also today, full circle.
Full circle today.
You have come to Galway. I started this podcast by saying you came to Galway for a reason.
Yeah. So you're right. I did. I came to Galway to collect our second embryo. Very difficult decision. I'm now 46 and 2 months. I'm not in a position to transfer that second embryo, and given all the heartache we had with trying to hold on to Keila in utero, we're just, it wouldn't be in a position to transfer. Really difficult decision when you see everything that goes into creating an embryo, I couldn't discard it. So that embryo now is in a cold space in the boot of my car, which sounds dreadful, but it's going to be savoured in a beautiful piece of jewellery that I'm going to keep forever. And that other embryo, you know, that ring can be passed to Keila, and that's going to be her other little half on the journey. It's so special to kind of get the opportunity to get that embryo back, especially after so many embryos are discarded after testing. So it's a real full circle moment. Yeah.
How did you feel collecting it? Were you emotional?
I had made my peace with it. And I just feel so lucky to have the two kids. You know, no, I don't believe that embryo was meant to be, actually. I really do believe I was meant to have two kids, and I have them both. And if I'd been 10 years younger, would I have transferred it? Of course, 5 years younger, I would have. But I don't believe it was actually meant to be. And I have real peace around that. I don't know where that's coming from. You know, maybe it's himself. I don't know. But I just think, yeah, I have what I meant to have. And I just want everyone who wants the same as what I have to have that, you know, because it just comes so easily to some people, and they have their own crosses to bear, don't get me wrong, but I just feel like it's a really tough thing to struggle with, you know, certain times of the year and everything. So I feel really grateful and really lucky, and I feel good. I couldn't have had this conversation with you 2 years ago, and thanks for bringing this platform, because I cannot tell you the amount of revisiting of that night and those times that we've done as a family in the last 2 weeks, when I've gone, who was still there and who did this, and you know, because you forget, you know. And there was nothing like this when we were grieving Dad, and had there been, I would have been listening to this every night. So thank you for creating a safe, because I felt very safe here today. It was really nice to be able to revisit the great things about Dad and not just how he died. So thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. Lynn, you've been on quite a journey in your life. So much, so much, so much. But you've a lot to share. You know, it's two massive topics, I suppose, if you want to put it that way. I don't want to gloss over it. But, you know, loss by, you know, traumatic loss like that, and the fertility journey.
Yeah.
You are reaching so many different people that will really need to hear your voice today. I don't take it for granted to come in and speak about something so difficult. Is, you know, it's really, really private and it's hard. But you're another person who's come into this room and has graciously given back to help others. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Cathy.